You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. Watch highlights from this and other Office Hours interviews on YouTube at youtube.com/Belfer Center. Arup sat down with Calder Walton, the author of Empire of Secrets, British Intelligence, the Cold War, and the Twilight of Empire. He is also an Ernest May Fellow in History and Policy with the Belfer Center's International Security Program.
Now, you started life, professional life, as a lawyer, as a barrister, as they call it in the UK.
Yeah.
What drew you to intelligence, and do you just love secrets?
Yeah, exactly. I'm obsessed with secrets.
It's like a
moth to a flame, right? No, actually, I was studying intelligence history before I became a barrister. And it was just a matter of being at the right place at the right time. I was interested in intelligence history. I'd read lots of books by my PhD supervisor about the KGB and so on. Mm. And then the day that I was starting my master's at Cambridge, my supervisor became the authorized official historian of MI5 and offered me an opportunity I couldn't refuse, which was to do a couple of days a week part-time research at MI5 headquarters. The security service, MI5, it's the longest continuing security service in the world and has probably the most complete intelligence archive of any intelligence service in the world.
And it's open.
It's completely classified. But they are declassifying records on a rolling basis a couple times a year. But they wanted to write their official history to come out in 2009 for their 100-year centenary history.
Wow.
And to do that, they needed a historian and he needed research
assistants. But now that history would be classified.
No, it's published.
Oh,
that is. So it's called Defense of the Realm, or over here, Defend the Realm. And it was the sort of the inner secrets of MI5, as much as we could say, published in 2009.
But it's different. MI5 is different from MI6 that way.
That's right.
Is that right? So
that's right.
What's the difference and why does one release classified information or declassified information?
Well, you've asked a really good question. And I think the people in MI6 might have some difficult questions put to them about that. Because, well, MI5, think of it as broadly FBI and CIA. One is concerned with domestic security intelligence and one is foreign intelligence or espionage. And MI6, or SIS as they call it, is an espionage service. So it's recruiting agents abroad. And MI5 is much more concerned with domestic. But actually what we found out when we're doing the history is that it was domestic within the whole of the British Empire. So in the 20th century, it's not just Britain and the UK, but it makes a big difference. So liaison in India, Southeast Asia, all over Africa, West Indies, all over the world, they had liaison and responsibilities.
And so why does the MI, I mean, because in the United States, the CIA does, I mean, it does keep things classified, but it declassifies.
Yeah.
And why does the MI6 want to keep it?
Well, I think that there's conceptually something. I mean, I think things are changing. I mean, we should start off by saying this is like compared to where we were just 20, 30 years ago, this is extraordinary, the fact that these agencies even exist. Mm. I mean, for most of the 20th century, they didn't exist. It was just non-avowed.
I see.
So, you know, London buses would drive past MI5 and say, all off for MI5, but it was an official secret, so nobody would talk about it.
Interesting.
And so they didn't exist in the history books. They didn't exist, you know, there was a non-avowed, non-officially recognized agencies, even though we now see they were busy, of course, throughout the 20th century.
And then one day somebody was just like, we should...
Well, it was actually thanks to, it's a good old historian, it was Sir Stephen Lander, who was head of MI5 in the late 1990s, who was a Cambridge PhD in medieval history. And he said, you know what, we're sitting on an archive of really important historical records. And it's just crazy that this isn't out there, for good and bad, you know, use and abuse of intelligence. And it would also help the public understand what intelligence does and what it can't do, what it can do. So he started to authorize the release of records. So it's been about releases. There are about, I think, 5,000 records now, multi-volume, out in the public domain now, in the National Archives in the UK. And then this centenary history as well. So,
do you have a favorite secret?
Well, I keep coming back to the Second World War. I think that the stories about the Second World War, you just can't. The deception operations,
the Cambridge Five, that whole
the Cambridge spies. I mean, how Soviet intelligence penetrated British intelligence during the war. So British and the US were trying to fight the Germans, and the Soviet Union was much more obsessed about their allies.
During the
during the Second World War.
Wow.
Yeah. So the there was an open door, basically, and the Soviets exploited it.
And what do they do?
Well, they managed to get one person, probably the most successful agent they had, Kim Philby, into MI6. And at one point, well, he became the head of the department in MI6 that was dealing with Soviet counterespionage.
That's pretty successful.
That's quite successful. Yeah. And then in the post-war years, he nearly became head of MI6.
Now, Kim Philby, he was one of the Cambridge Five, or
that's
he was
right.
part of
yeah.
that group. There was
Don McLean,
or there were a few of those.
McLean, Burgess, yeah. Blunt, and we now know Cairncross as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, but they had these, so they were just like recruiting at universities for people who were...
That's right. The KGB had talent spotters at Cambridge and other universities.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of... bit of a thing people say, well, maybe there was an Oxford spy ring as well, but they were just more successful. They didn't get caught. And there are actually, there are some records now showing that the KGB was also active at Oxford. Yeah. Why wouldn't they be? You know, it's not just going to be Cambridge.
And so was the UK just, the UK wasn't concerned, or the UK was looking at this as well. It wasn't.
Yeah, they were.
They knew that they were open and vulnerable to,
that's right.
They had communist student groups and things like that, right?
Precisely. And I mean, all the way through the, as we now call it, the pre-war years, the main focus was on the Soviet Union. And there was sort of this surging threat of fascism and Nazism, but it was actually predominantly the communist threat.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the Second World War broke out, Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were allied.
That's right. Or they had a pact.
They had a pact.
That's right.
They had a non-aggression pact.
Mm.
So actually, they were the British intelligence was desperately trying to monitor what was going on. But they were just looking in the wrong places. And with hindsight, it's all so clear. But at the time, it just seemed that there wasn't enough information to go on.
Do you think the Soviets and the Russians today are more successful at recruiting foreign agents than the US and UK are?
I mean, it's difficult to say today, but certainly historically, the great achievements in intelligence history seem to be... seem to have been done by
Soviet.
The Russians and the
Why?
Soviets.
Why is that?
I think it's just, it goes right back. And this is one of the things that I'm going to be trying to bring out in this big new history that I'm writing, the Cambridge History of Espionage and Intelligence, is actually for Russia, this isn't a sort of a Cold War aberration, but this goes right back to the medieval period about spying and about intelligence
that
gathering.
That long ago.
Oh, yeah. And even longer. And actually, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the mid-1990s, the head of the new Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, Primakov, got authorized a history to look back, not just the Soviet KGB history, but he went all the way back to Ivan the Terrible, and he said there's a straightforward continuity between Russian intelligence in the 16th century all the way through the Bolshevik period, through the communist period, to the present day.
And those are that continuity, those are norms, those are rules, those are practices, tactics.
Yeah. Tactics, surveillance, it's about turning people, it's about gathering compromising material over people, compromat. So when we in the West sort of plunged rather inexperiencedly into this game of intelligence in the 20th century, we're facing, I think it's safe to say, countries that have done this for centuries. So we've got some pretty tough... America didn't have a foreign intelligence gathering service until after the Second World War.
Right, 47. Was this the establishment of the CIA?
Yeah, a peacetime dedicated intelligence. It beggars belief, but that's the case.
And so you see... do you see Russia's actions today as part of that continuity, as something almost predictable?
Yeah, I think that it's entirely unsurprising that Russia has attempted to interfere in U.S. Presidential elections. They did it in the 1960s, they did it in the 70s, and in the 80s. It appears, I mean, we'll wait to see what Robert Mueller comes back with in his report, but it appears that they were simply more successful using cyber means today than they had been in the past. They certainly tried to gather compromising material over Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to incite rallies against Reagan. They didn't work. But it looks like, from my perspective, historical perspective, it looks like what they've done using cyber is to be able to do what they didn't do in the past.
Well,
this isn't just us saying, oh, there's continuity. Right. It's that the SVR today actually embraces
the
their
SVR.
Own history. The SVR is Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service.
That's right.
Yeah. And the FSB, they embrace their past, and they are learning from their own KGB history.
Really?
So they, why would they not? I mean, look at Putin.
It's an institution. Yeah, so you, and so it's not really Putin that we should be thinking about. It's this culture and history of...
It is, but it's Putin. Putin adopts that culture and history, and he's part of it. I mean, he comes from it. He was a KGB officer.
Yeah.
So the idea that we can just suddenly get along with him, I think, is sort of turning making yourself blind to the history, the baggage that that comes with. It's not possible, but we've got some serious challenges ahead of us.
And what do they do? What are the sort of tactics? How do you get? Well, there's all sorts of intelligence gathering.
Yeah.
The most fun are the human intelligence. Human intelligence.
That's right.
How do you get agents?
Well, here's an example. Okay. Here's a good example. So I just interviewed recently the former head of the Czech intelligence deception. Department. So that's the Czech intelligence service in the Eastern Bloc that was working for the KGB. And he's now retired and he lives up the coast in Massachusetts. And he's a painter in his spare time. And he told me, and he defected to the US in the 1960s, and he told me that his first job when he joined the STB, the Czech intelligence service, working for the Moscow, was to open a bordello, as he called it, in East Germany. And he would get Western diplomats and Western businessmen to come in and have a good time and sit behind the mirror and take pictures. And then this would be classic compromising material, compromat. So then they would present this to the people and they would get them hook, line,
sinker. So it wasn't always that people had communist sympathies, as is often thought of with the Cambridge Five.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Also they would get them to do certain things.
That's right.
And purposefully.
That's right.
I mean, this comes back to Trump in many ways.
It does. And so the idea, I mean, who knows if there is actually compromising material on Trump, but the idea that the FSB or the SVR, the Russian intelligence services today, would be doing that is not surprising.
At all.
There would be, I mean, there's a long history of exactly that, going right back to the Bolshevik Revolution, about ensnaring people, using compromising material to blackmail them and to do things for Moscow's advantage.
Interesting.
So that's not to say, of course, I mean, there is a live debate, as you're probably aware today, about what Western powers have done that is similar. I mean, you know, we'd be naive to say that Britain and America haven't done similar things.
The U.S. and Britain have meddled in elections done so for decades.
That's
and so who are we to say... This is wrong.
That's right. I think that the people from British and U.S. intelligence would be quick to point out that they were not always successfully, but at least attempting to do so in the cause of democracy. And I think that there's also something fundamentally different about comparing the KGB to MI6 and CIA. The KGB instigated the greatest peacetime repression in modern European history. They killed probably more people than any other intelligence service in history.
That I can take, but the first thing about in the name of democracy, to me that feels,
I agree. I mean, the jury's out. And you know, now the exciting thing about working on this subject is that these archives are opening up and we can now see, you know, well, we were trying to export democracy, and it's like where you look at the records and it's like, well, that looks a bit more sordid on the ground than it does with high convoluted ideas.
It seemed more that the United States was more interested in amity with other countries rather than promoting democracy at certain moments.
Yeah, I think that the way I'd look at it is the US and Britain, often working very closely together, were that the main objective strategic was anti-communism in whichever country.
That's right.
So supporting regimes that were just emphatically anti-communist. Yeah. And whether that meant that they were authoritarian, well, sometimes that was the case.
I see.
But certainly Britian and America did meddle in
Iran, Chile, etc.
Right. Yeah, of course. So this is, I think, what I'm trying to do with the history I'm doing here is to actually have a grown-up public debate about that. That it is just, you know, that you, some of the stuff you read in the news today about, like, can't believe Russia has interfered in a presidential election.
Right.
Well, first of all, we don't know the history of so-called Russian active measures. They've been doing it for
active decades. Measures meaning
covert action. That's what Russia calls covert action.
Okay.
We would call covert action. And that Russia has been attempting to do it in the US and other countries for decades.
Yeah.
But also we need to have a grown-up conversation. Well, one of the first things that the CIA did after being set up in 1947 was to interfere in the Italian elections in 1948. Time to have a really sort of honest, open debate.
And what do we learn from this?
Well, unfortunately, that democracies do get involved in some pretty dirty tricks.
Yeah.
And the CIA was definitely involved in some dirty tricks in the Italian elections in 1948. What other skeletons are also in the CIA
closet?
We don't know. Hopefully, we'll find out, you know, as these documents come out more and more.
But to the other point about Russia, that they've been doing it for a long time, how do we learn from that? Do we just get better at being suspicious about them? Do we actually have tactics to fight fire with fire?
Yeah, well, it's not helped, I think, I think that there are some really clear analogies with things that have happened in the Cold War about dealing with Russian covert action or disinformation, what we'd call fake news. Mm. So Britain and the US set up information agencies, propaganda, counter-Russian propaganda agencies, to deal with all of these forgeries that were coming out of from the KGB that they were slipping into.
These like pamphlets and newspapers and things?
Yeah, things like saying that the American government created the AIDS virus, and that they were butchering children in Central America in order to harvest the body parts.
Wow.
The JFK assassination, that went on for decades. The KGB in an internal memo.
They feed these conspiracy theories.
They tap into something.
Yeah.
This is what you learn when you look at Russian disinformation. You can't create this. They're quite clear. You can't create the big lie out of nothing. There needs to be an existing sentiment, some sort of anti-Americanism, and then you essentially grab hold of that and put it in a place where it's going to get much more airtime. So slipping it into a pro-communist newspaper, and then then other newspapers can then pick it up, but leave out the important bit that actually this was the authenticity of the underlying document has not been verified. So then it just, in using our language, it would go viral. So in the 1960s, the CIA stood up in front of Congress and identified 32 different forgeries that they'd identified from the KGB. And they're all sort of portraying America as the aggressor, that America is imperialist. Well, what are they trying to do? They're trying to instigate distrust in the American public, in their government. So sowing the seeds of conspiracy. We can't trust our government. And they're trying to this is from the 1950s onwards, they're trying to undermine Western alliances like NATO.
It sounds so familiar.
I can't imagine where I've heard that before.
There are
echoes here staring you in the face.
Well, when the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States, does not believe his own intelligence and distrust and feeds the conspiracy theories.
That's right.
Is that the kind of holy grail?
I just imagine the champagne must be flowing in the Kremlin every single day because this is beyond anything that they could have ever thought of in the Cold War. We've got a commander in chief, as you said, who rates Putin's word apparently over his own intelligence community. Yeah. And so, in terms of intelligence history, I've never seen anything like this. So it's an exciting time to be researching this.
How old is espionage in intelligence?
Very old, and it goes right back to the Bible. Go spy out the land, I think.
God was spying.
Yeah, God was spying. So this goes right back. And we are, my colleague and I, Christopher Andrew, and I are editing the new Cambridge History of Espionage and Intelligence. And it's a three-volume project, and it starts off in the ancient world, and it goes all the way through the medieval period, through the early modern to the present day.
Starts in the ancient world.
Yeah.
So the ancient Egyptians, Romans,
precisely.
they were
using espionage, and they were gathering intelligence. And one of the big narrative things that we're making in this volume is that different cultures and different regimes and different societies made the same discoveries about intelligence. And then it was forgotten, and there wasn't this transmission of ideas. So actually, sort of people discovered the same thing. The ancient Islamic cultures were hundreds of years ahead of Europe at the time. People think that Romans were good at. I mean, it was the ancient Islamic caliphates that, in terms of code breaking, their codes were literally centuries ahead of everybody else.
I mean, in terms of hieroglyphics and things.
Yeah. Well, in terms of actually underlying ability to be able to write codes and crack codes. And then it was actually what was interesting then, Europe caught up in the Renaissance. We can now see they discovered, without actually actively looking back at what the ancient Islamic cultures were doing.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, this is a great code. And it's like, well, that had actually already been discovered 700 years before.
Yeah.
So if somebody had actually written down and said, this is probably quite a good way to write a code, and this is what we might want to learn about breaking codes, and this is how you pass over sensitive information.
Yeah.
Nobody did that.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of both informing our understanding of history, because it's generally missing, you know, people have little anecdotes about intelligence, but it's not really sort of taken seriously, but also a sort of public policy of you know, this is the impact of, this is what intelligence can do, this is what it has done, and this is what we can learn. That's my aim with this big project.
You're working on this, you're co-editing this three-volume set, 90 chapters on the history of, Cambridge history of intelligence and espionage.
That's right.
And of course, it's a history, but in doing so, you're making an argument and by how you're separating the volumes.
Yeah.
The turning points you've mentioned are the Renaissance and World War II.
That's right, World War I think.
World War I, excuse me.
I think that's sort of the massive watershed in terms of...
Why those two moments?
Well, I think, as I said, I think that the Renaissance fits quite nicely in terms of this is when Europe discovers many of the things that had already been discovered before.
Yeah.
And that sort of seems like a natural sort of...
And it went ahead. It took off.
Precisely, that's right. And then other cultures that had been previously... you know, pioneering intelligence, ancient China, for example, certainly weren't as advanced in the 16th, 17th, 18th century as Europe was in terms of code breaking and other forms of intelligence gathering. But then really the big watershed moment is with the First World War, and it's with total warfare, where countries were fighting, throwing all their resources at fighting a war. And that meant surveillance of populations in a way that had never been done before.
Really? And that's when they built these bigger bureaucracies
didn't exist. Big bureaucracies, massive forms of interception of communications, new technologies that were allowing that. So that was, as we see it, another big watershed. And then I think that then what we're seeing at the moment with the cyber digital revolution is a... We can't even imagine where this is going to go.
Really?
But I think that it's going to be profound.
Given that all these moments, they don't seem to hinge exactly on specific heads of state, that makes me wonder, is Trump, you know, in this era of Trump, where he does distrust his intelligence community, and there is great fear that that'll have long-term effects, will it, or are these things much bigger than a single commander-in-chief?
I'd like to think that it won't make that much of a difference, but I am profoundly worried about the damage that he's doing and the public distrust that he's whipped up in institutions that have been a bedrock of American democracy for decades, generations. So I think that what he's unleashed in terms of post-fact, post-truth, that actually there's no such thing as even a fact anymore.
Right.
I mean, in the Cold War, we never had to deal with that. There were facts, you know. There was a grand narrative. Right. What does America stand for?
Rudy Giuliani say facts aren't fact, right?
This is their alternative facts. This is Orwellian. Right. It's absolutely extraordinary. So
where does that lead us, though? What?
I think this is where, unfortunately, historians sort of...
throw their hands up?
Yeah, and say, well, now maybe we need some sort of social scientists or psychologists, public psychologists, because I don't know. I mean, we are witnessing... You know, in terms of the means of communication, it's similar. I'm not the first person to say this, but it's like the development of the printing press in the early modern period. And look what that unleashed in terms of the transmission of ideas and the civil wars that created in Europe. And I think that the digital revolution will have a similar sort of impact, social dislocation, in ways that are difficult to predict. I think that as historians, we can safely say that we need to be cautious because of problems in the past this, about just not trusting our institutions.
Well, you've related it to the Cold War, certain things.
Yeah.
So what do we draw from those historical analogies and episodes?
Well, I was recently reading a memoirs of a Soviet defector, KGB defector, and they asked them exactly this question in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. They said, well, what advice do you have for the American public in terms of dealing with disinformation coming out of the Kremlin? And he said, I just think that the most important thing is to read and read and read and read editorial newspapers and to read across a variety of different news sources so that you get a broad sort of compass. And then he also said, you know, in terms of ways of dealing with it, he said the most important thing is for America not to sort of have a polemic, because that won't work, but just to nail down facts and to say this is not true what the Moscow is saying or another country is saying, that is not accurate, that's not a fact. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, as we've already said, now we seem to be in the position where there aren't facts.
Right.
So
I mean,
that's pretty bleak.
That is bleak, and it feels that if we're talking about asking people to read,
yeah,
right, which anyway people are reluctant to do, but then also to read multiple sources, that seems to me a generational struggle.
I think
that
you're
right. It seems to me that even if Trump is not reelected in 2020, that the problem won't fix itself immediately.
I think you're absolutely right, Eric. I think that the demons that have been unleashed is a generational struggle. Mm-hmm. And I think that looking at intelligence history, there's only so much that can really be that a covert agency of any mm-hmm. kind can help with in this kind of generational. Yeah. This is a sort of societal effort. And I think that it will require things like education, starting very early on in schools about what is fake, what is fact, what is fiction, how do you separate nonsense from reality.
Well, Calder, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
Really great.
Appreciate it.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.